The government announces the Special Educational Needs and Alternative Provision Improvement Plan. Persistent absenteeism comes under the spotlight, and extra funding for inclusive sport.
Good to see you again, everyone, and welcome back to the March 2023 episode of the Schools and Academy Show podcast. This time, we're joined by two very special guests.
Shortly, we'll be hearing from Sarah Baker, the CEO of Team Education Trust, and Carl Poupe, author of Action Hero Teacher.
Having two guests for the first time means it's going to be a packed episode, so let's just jump right into it.
So 2022 saw the release of the SEND Review, or the Green Paper. This highlighted a number of challenges to the provision of special educational needs across England. Primarily, these challenges were that outcomes for children and young people with SEND or in alternative provision can be poor and inconsistent across the country. Navigating the SEND and AP system was challenging and difficult for parents and children. And finally, despite investment into the system, the provision was not cost-effective.
These issues run deep through the SEND and AP space, which is why we've recently seen a follow-up to the Green Paper in the form of the SEND and AP Improvement Plan, which was published earlier this month on the 2nd of March.
The Improvement Plan was produced off the back of a consultation with the Department for Education, in collaboration with over 4,500 respondents from across the sector, including young people, carers, parents, teachers, and heads.
With the number of issues haunting the SEND and AP space and the number of people consulted, it's hardly surprising that they produced such a massive document at over 100 pages long. Don't worry, we're not going to sit here and read the whole thing out to you, we'd be here for hours. But we are going to summarise the three key themes that were identified within, and we'll make sure to put a link to the document in the description so you can go through it in your own time.
These themes are to strengthen accountabilities, develop a financially sustainable system to deliver improved outcomes, and develop a skilled workforce with excellent leadership. There will also be significant increase to the budget for SEND and AP, taking the high needs expenditure to north of £10 billion.
Increased spending is not the only change you should expect to see. A few more include the introduction of a new leadership level SEND co-NPQ, new National Special Educational Needs and Alternative Provision Standards, which henceforth will be just called the National Standards, and a new EHCP dashboard.
To discuss these changes and the implications of the plan, it would be a good time to consult one of our expert guests this month, Sarah Baker. Sarah, thank you for joining us. Would you like to introduce yourself for our listeners?
Hello, my name's Sarah Baker. I'm the CEO of Team Education Trust, which is a trust based in Derbyshire with three converted schools. We also have a sponsor school, and we've developed a lot of partnerships and collaborative partners through our traded service. Real privilege to be speaking with you today and be part of the pre-show podcasts. Team for me has a real clear vision about meeting all students' needs. Inclusion is at the heart of everything we do. So actually, this particular topic is really at the heart of our strategy as we move forward and we're planning for next academic year. But actually, it's embracing the world that's really important to us. It's about every pupil. I also need to just say that come and see us when we're out and about at the Schools and Academy Show, because we do have a theatre session, Everything Everywhere, The Power of the Dashboard, and I think you'd find that really exciting as well.
So I guess let's just jump right to it, Sarah. Obviously, we're discussing the SEND and AP Improvement Plan, which is a follow-up to the Green Paper released in 2022. Many people have felt that this was a long time coming, given the issues identified in the Green Paper, and have been following along closely with its release. However, for those not involved in the SEND and AP space, could you maybe just give an idea of the journey we've been on with its production?
I'm sure alongside other trusts, engaged really with the consultation process and been able to discuss sort of parts of the proposals that were put in front of us. That was really exciting. And as part of the SEND and AP National Network of CEOs, where I'm one of the executives, we've been heavily involved in the journey with the DfE and those discussions and the opportunities where the DfE has welcomed our opinions and our input. So from our point of view, it's been really pivotal that we've been able to sort of shape some of those opportunities. we're really looking forward to better outcomes in the sense of across the whole sector, and what that means for both special schools as well as mainstream. But also it'll be, the devil's going to be in some of the detail around those national standards and the consistency and actually those approaches and the implications for SENCOs. So I think as we move forward, it'll be really interesting to see how things channel through so that we actually get the best outcomes. I think we went some way when we had the Children and Families Act back in 2014. But again, there were still some elements which just weren't working in a really collaborative way. So I'm hoping that the way that the journey has gone so far, the openness of the DfE has really led to an exciting time for SEND to be really, and alternative provision to be at the heart of what we do. And I suppose something else that's really positive that's come out from it, we do now have a SEND and AP directorate within the department. So it's quite clear that colleagues are listening to us, and we have been able to be involved in those steering groups and round tables. So from the bigger picture, I think it's exciting, and I think there's a lot to come forward. From a perspective of looking at it from a trust point of view, our Trust SEND team have been busy sort of looking at our own practices and the wider implications and what that workload will look like for SENCOs, but also as a trust that's very much about inclusion, how the work we already do already fits some of those key areas. So for me, it'd be interesting to see about innovative solutions as well to creating capacity and provision, but also looking at how we validate some of the work that's already done and look at sharing sort of best practice and how that can be scaled up, especially sharing that with our mainstream colleagues.
Would you say that there's a feeling of hope in the SEND and AP space right now, that this improvement plan could be the tip of the iceberg for meaningful reform?
I would say definitely so. I think that's why I say the word exciting, because it's going to go one of two ways. And I think the drive from definitely the CEOs that I've been meeting from the SEND and AP network is really, really positive. And we're really looking forward to, as I said, the detail really, then how that's going to be implemented in a very meaningful way for that young person and their family. And ultimately, it's about making that difference down on the ground.
And it sounds like the DfE has been really collaborative actually with the wider sector in during the consultation process and putting forward this plan. We're going to see an introduction of a new SEND level NPQ along with the national standards, and we're also going to see an amended SEND code of practice. How do you see this developing the role of the SENCO, and fundamentally, what are the essential skills and attributes that this qualification will need to deliver for our SEND practitioners?
So personally, as a SENCO, when I sort of came through into this area, I think it was really exciting to have a qualification initially. So the fact that this is going on to the NPQ suite of qualifications, I think, again, I go back to that word exciting, because for me, it validates the fact that this is a really critical role within school. But I think we've got to step back and say that it's positive to ensure that that's that leadership level qualification, because leaders are the ones that are able to make the, I suppose, biggest influence across an organisation. And so be part of that strategic decision making. But wider than that, it's really exciting that SEND is going to have that level of expertise across all of the layers. And it goes back to every teacher should be a teacher of SEND. And I think if we can actually embrace that and have that at that leadership level, then I think that's really important. I think SENCOs are going to have a tough role to play and are going to need that support to be able to go into the classroom and be that practitioner that can work across different subject areas with teaching materials, feel very comfortable with an understanding of all the different needs of young people, so that they can really be seen and respected in that role. I think from my point of view, not only have they got to embrace the changes and bring that strategic development on, they need to be really good practitioners in their own right to be able to develop that wider role. So I think those leadership skills are going to be really important, but actually then how they then deliver those, I suppose the quality of that communication in their own practice. And they're definitely going to need some coaching and mentoring skills in their toolbox to come out to work with their colleagues. And maybe a sprinkling of positivity, because I think sometimes it can be incredibly challenging when you're dealing with different situations. I used to always say it's useful to have a magic wand as a SENCO, because you can then spread solutions which maybe were always seen as maybe hard to reach, those blue skies.
Thanks for that, Sarah. Speaking of different situations, let's change gears just slightly here to talk about the infrastructure a bit more. We know that the role of local authorities are changing with the expansion of MATS. Do you see LAs changing their role and functions working within this improvement plan?
Well, I think local authorities will always have their statutory duties and they'll be central to the requirements of what's being delivered. And I think it's important that we recognise that because they have their own local area SEND plans and we need to be sort of working with and mirroring those through our own developments. But again, MATS are also positive system leaders. So we need to also think very carefully about how, as MAT leaders, we're working with our local authorities. And I think whilst there's still that really equal sort of mix, those working relationships are really positive. And there are some really strong partnerships out there that really exist between trusts and local authorities. And I can talk quite passionately about, you know, where it's working and some of those examples of best practice. And we're always going to have to work with our local authorities around commissioning, especially around special educational needs placements. So I think it's about that collaborative approach and being able to meet young people's needs. And if we're all coming at it for the best of the young people, then I think that's probably the place to sit and to start from. And I think we'll probably get the best from all areas of the sector then.
But it's about making sure it's not politicised, isn't it? That's quite a tricky thing at times. So last year we saw the new area SEND inspection framework. How closely does this new inspection framework marry with the improvement plan? Are the two documents talking to each other and are they working in conjunction with each other?
So I think there is an alignment and it is welcomed. And I think the role of commissioners and providers to ensure high quality work and provision is critical to the sector. You know, there's the welcome of that challenge of scrutiny and the overlap. But we also need to understand that, you know, standards need to be met and we should embrace the way in which things are changing and shaping and moving forward and the direction of travel. And as things move forward, we need to be aware of the fact that we might need to go back and review and look at how things move forward. But yes, I would say there's an alignment and we're pleased with the level of scrutiny that's being there from a challenge point of view.
Well, I think that just about brings us to the end of our questions. Do you have anything you'd like to say before you go, Sarah?
Thank you very much for listening today. And it's been an absolute pleasure to be able to share sort of the SEND and alternative provision improvement plan, I suppose, ways forward and some of the questions that are coming out from it. So, yeah, I look forward to meeting you at the conference.
So keeping the train moving around inclusion, let's now move on to an issue that predominantly affects the most vulnerable learners, that being absenteeism. Earlier this month, on the 7th of March, the Education Affairs Select Committee met to discuss the issue of persistent absenteeism, which has been plaguing schools across the country.
I actually watched this meeting, and the numbers to come out of it were staggering. According to Dame Rachel D'Souza, the Children's Commissioner for England, some 818,000 of the 1.6 million pupils persistently absent from school were off due to reasons other than illness. There also tends to be a spike in the number of children absent on a Friday, which some believe to be linked to the fact that parents and carers are working from home.
Now, because we may all have our own idea of what it means to be persistently absent, it's important that we establish that the committee views persistent absenteeism as pupils not being in school for about 10% of a term, which works out at roughly 7 days a term. And if pupils are missing 50% or more of their sessions at a school, then this is classified as a severe absence.
That's not all to come out of the meeting. 25% of all pupils were persistently absent last term, and for some context, it was just 13.1% in the autumn term of 2019. To combat this, D'Souza wants Ofsted to have greater focus around attendance and attendance data.
During the meeting, both D'Souza and fellow witness Alice Wilcock, who's head of education at the Centre for Social Justice, raised concern over the use of the code B in reporting attendance.
The B code is supposed to denote that the child is in another educational setting. Both D'Souza and Alice Wilcock have noted that there is inconsistent use of this code when reporting attendance.
Official guidance says that the B code should be used for kids who are involved in school activities but are off-site. Think of school trips, sports matches, etc. Wilcock expressed that she had heard cases of schools using B codes when pupils were being trialled at another setting. And on that note, I think it's about time that we throw things over to our second guest today, Carl Poupe. Carl, thank you for joining us. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So thank you very much for having me. My name is Carl Poupe, or Carl C. Poupe, FRSA. I'm an educational consultant, former teacher now, and I've been in the education sector for almost 15 years. I've worked in numerous jobs, and my specialism is helping SEN and SEMH children, so special educational needs, and special social, emotional, and mental health needs. Say that fast 15 times. So these are children that have got considerable learning difficulties, and my speciality was to help them. And I did that through being a NEETS coordinator and alternative provision. Then I did a similar thing in alternative provision in mainstream schooling. And then I became a consultant after writing two books and on my way to writing a third.
Fantastic stuff. All right, let's just get the show on the road, shall we? So persistent absenteeism has been a massive issue in schools ever since the pandemic. We're currently seeing around 25% of pupils being persistently absent, meaning they're missing around 7 days a term. What do you think are some of the big steps that schools can take to help bring this number down?
That's a very, very interesting question. I did speak about this in the Action Era Teacher too, because what we've got is we've got a combination of really huge macro factors, things that are happening in the world, combined with what's going on in the UK, and it's become a bit of a perfect storm. So just to give a bit of context on this, I remember listening to an educational podcast. I think it was the head of IBM. I'm not too sure. Was it the head of Satchel? I'm not too sure, but I'll never forget this quote, what he said. He said, what the coronavirus has done for online teaching or advancing technology, using modern technology in teaching, what it's basically done is it's accelerated it by up to 20 years. And what he meant by that was he was saying basically along the lines of this individual, I've forgotten his name, it's going to drive me mad. But he said when he was going to schools and talking about online teaching and talking about, you know, using things like Satchel and whatnot, nobody was interested. This was pre-pandemic, by the way. You know, so pre-2020, no one was really interested in doing all this online stuff. But as the pandemic started to, or should I say the lockdown started to roll on, he goes, people are literally banging on my door to try and get all this online learning to come around. So basically it's advanced that. So what you've got, there's a number of factors. Number one, the first factor I would say in terms of why I believe absenteeism is increasing is mental health and the mental health concerns of parents, both the parents and the children. I was reading the latest statistics from Young Minds, which is the UK's leading young people's mental health charity, was quite sobering. So they did a commission where they were looking at, they were doing reports about how the coronavirus has affected our young people. And it's quite frightening. So they were saying, for example, that I believe 1 in 6 children between the age of 5 and 16 will have some form of mental health challenge, which is increased from 1 in 9 in 2018. And I would say that this was taken during 2020 or 2021. I would say those numbers will increase. 86% of young people said that their mental health was adversely affected by the coronavirus. 1 in 3 children that have got some form of mental health crisis do not have access to NHS help. As we know, because of what's happened with the cuts, unfortunately, not to get political, but what's happened with the cuts over time, and also because of the cost of living and so on and so forth, we've got a lot of young people that have not got access to these services. And what that does is, and I'm speaking as a parent myself, my child is quite young, but I can imagine if my child was a teenager, where you've got children who do feel concerned about what's going on in the world with the coronavirus, and we're forgetting all the other things like the environment, which is quite frightening as well, the degradation of the environment. We've got the war with Russia and Ukraine. So our mental health is taking an absolute battering. We've all suffered a collective trauma during the coronavirus. And I think what's happened with a lot of parents, and I'm not saying this is just the only reason, I'm just giving some contextual answers here, is that a lot of parents are almost saying, look, if it's too difficult for you to go to school, I'd rather you just stay at home. Because of the work patterns as well, the changing work patterns with parents, so a lot more people are working from home, they can make those allowances. So what this pandemic has done is it's opened up options to people that would have not existed 2 years ago, 2 to 3 years ago. I think as well, and again, I'm not saying this is just only mental health, but I'm saying there's a lot of factors. I think what else has happened is there's disillusionment from our young people in regards to education, especially when we're looking at the cost of living crisis, the inflation, the housing crisis as well. And I deal with a lot of generations as students who, you know, maybe are talking to fellow millennials here, but we were almost sold a dream where you say, you know, you go to uni, you get yourself a good job, you get yourself a house, a nice pension, a nice car, you know, have a holiday, have 2.4 kids, and, you know, your life's sorted. Hasn't worked out that way for a lot of my generation, unfortunately, hasn't worked out that way. So what we've got is we've got the younger generation coming up and saying, you know what, we've seen our older siblings or our uncles or aunts go through the system. Things are not quite working out. You know, you'll get young people saying they want to be influencers and YouTubers, the same way we used to say we want to be lawyers and doctors. The same way that we study 1939, 1945, 1963, 1969 is the same way 100 years from now, historians will be looking back at this time between 2019 beyond and saying the world has changed forever. For me, what the pandemic has done is it's the equivalent of 9/11. I'm sure you remember 9/11. We remember the world before 9/11 and the world after 9/11. There was a marked shift. And I believe we're at one of those turning points in the world as well. And what we're seeing now in terms of absenteeism and so on and so forth are symptoms of something greater that's coming down the road. And I've even mentioned AI. So I think there's a lot of factors that we can kind of talk about.
I think you're absolutely right that we need to look at this more on a macro scale and look at all the factors involved. It's really interesting to hear you start to begin to describe the role of the parents there. Obviously, we originally mentioned schools, but schools are just one stakeholder when it comes to pupil absence. And there are multiple other groups involved. If we look at it through this lens, with a school as part of a chain, how could schools engage with other key stakeholders and ensure that absence remains low?
In my first book, The Action of a Teacher, I actually spoke about this called the student triangle. And this is what I learned. This is actually one of my mentors. When I was learning how to teach, my mentor mentioned this to me. And I remember, because I was really frustrated, I was dealing with one particular student and I was so frustrated. I'm like, I'm putting in all the hours. And at the time I was working in a primary school as a TA and I was doing like a lot of speech and language. And this young man had SEN and SEMH. And I was like, you know, I get him ready. I set him up every day. He leaves the school day feeling happy. And I feel like I'm making progress. And then the next day it's like starts from the beginning. And because I was fresh to teach, I'm like, what am I doing wrong? And my mentor told me, she said, you're not doing anything wrong. There's three, as you rightly said, there are three areas of a child's life that we've got to take in consideration. So you've got the person, right? The personality of the particular child. Have they got special educational needs, SEMH, so on and so forth? What are they like? Some people like to learn certain things, some people don't, right? So that's one area. The second area is the environment. The environment is everything from their family life, their domestic life, all the way to whether they live in a village or whether they live in a city. Their culture, their ethnicity, all these things are part of the environment. And then there's you that represents the school, all right? Now, already you're at a disadvantage. If we're going to take it as, you know, treat all three areas equally, you're only a third of the influence. But what she said to me, which was powerful, is not even that way. You're probably only 20% of the influence as a teacher. Anecdotally, the biggest factor in whether a child does well is their environment. The environment is absolutely key. So you can get two children who have got the same academic ability or the same levels. And because of the way that they're reared, because of their family, because of the culture and the context they're in, they'll have completely two different outcomes. And schools have got to get better at this. We've got to move from, and I think what we've done, a mistake we've made with schooling, and I always say this, that education has not been disrupted since its inception. It's a very ancient way of doing things. I'm sorry to say that. It's a very Edwardian system. I could go in my TARDIS, my time machine, right now, and I could kidnap Montgomery from a school in the 1800s and say, come to the 21st century and I'm going to show you modern schooling. And I take him in my TARDIS and I put him in the classroom. If I remove the whiteboard and I remove the speaker system and technology, he would know exactly what this is. He could perhaps teach. I could probably give him the schemes of work and he or she could go and teach, or they could go and teach the curriculum. So the way that we teach has not changed fundamentally in over 100 years. And the reason why I say this is that we have very much looked at education in a very narrow strata of grades, letters, numbers, you name it, right? We as educators have got to become smarter. And what I would say to teachers in this context is that we've got to work with the parents. We've got to work with the community. It's not enough just to say, and unfortunately, the reason why I say this is that, you know, I train a lot of teachers and they're like, look, my job is just to give them the material and help them to get the grades. It's not my job to, you know, be a social worker or whatnot. And I say, unfortunately, although it's not your job, it's becoming your job, because we haven't got, you know, everything has been cut, all the mental health has been cut. So you're going to have to deal with it. So I always say, I want you to be a paramedic rather than a surgeon. I'm not saying to be the child psychologist. I'm not saying that you stop the whole lesson and take the child out, give them cuddles, play basketball with them. It's not possible. That's not in your remit. But the same way a good first aider can help somebody who's in an emergency crisis is the same way as teachers, we've got to help them. And part of that work now is being able to. So what I'd say to answer your question, we have to work with the parents. We have to establish closer relationships with the parents, the closer relationships with the community. Because what we don't also understand is that sometimes parents have had a very negative experience of school and that filters onto their child. more often than not, and I can only say this anecdotally, when I'm dealing with a child that's really challenging, that doesn't want to engage, a school refuser, more often than not, the parent has had a bad experience at school. And you know what? Why I know this is because what will happen is the child will get in trouble. You say, "Mum, Dad, I'm getting in trouble at school." You say, "Don't worry about it, I'll deal with it." And they'll just tell you to F off or whatever. So you've got to work with the parent. If you don't get the parent or the caregivers on side or the community on side, you are not going to access that child and what or help that child. And again, we can even break it down in cultural levels. Especially after what happened with George Floyd and Black Lives Matter, finally schools were saying, "Look, we've got a problem." And I've spoken to schools saying, "Look, we are coming from a particular context. These children are coming from a particular context. We've noticed that the behavior and, you know, the engagement is low. And now we're realizing that because we're seen as outsiders or because we don't understand what these children are going through, we can't engage them, basically." So it's very, very important to summarize what I've just said. We as schools have got to kind of take off our tweed jackets, take out, you know, our pipes and say, "Look, we've got to educate holistically to the child rather than just being so focused on academic progress. We've got to be able to communicate with the parents, the caregivers and the community going forward in the future. That's what we've got to do."
I really love that model of the triangle. I think that's a really essential viewpoint for staff to take. It's important for them to realise that they're not Atlas holding up the sky. This burden isn't theirs alone to take, that there's factors outside of their control. That's an essential thing they need to realise, both for their own mental health, but also to better understand the context of a student and able to help their well-being. We'll come back to you in just a moment, Carl, but for now we just need to take the time to move on to our final story of the day, which is covering a shake-up in the rollout of PE.
On the 8th of March, Rishi Sunak announced that schools should now deliver 2 hours of PE per week. Schemes in place at the moment, such as the RUN programme delivered by Active Partnerships, will be developed and extended to offer more places to those who may not engage with sport as much, such as disadvantaged pupils, those with SEND, and girls.
Speaking of girls' sport, March 8th saw the celebration of International Women's Day, and the government used this to place the spotlight onto girls' sports provision in schools. This is part of a legacy programme which stems back from the Lionesses' victory at the Euros in 2022.
With this in mind, schools have been told that they must offer equal access to sport for both boys and girls, with an expanded version of the School's Games Mark Award being awarded to schools who successfully deliver equal opportunities for both boys and girls.
To help make these changes a reality, £600 million of primary PE and sport premium funding have been greenlit, along with £22 million for the School Games Organisers Network. A further £57 million have also been put forward to help keep school sports facilities open outside of the normal school day.
Current understanding is that neither requirement will be statutory, though Ofsted will be asked to check on equal access to sport following a pledge made by Rishi Sunak during the first 2022 Conservative leadership campaign to ask Ofsted to assess PE in every school.
These changes and their subsequent funding are being welcomed by school leaders as a step in the right direction. However, that doesn't mean that there are not still concerns over the changes in an already crammed curriculum.
Speaking with Schools Week, Jeff Barton, the General Secretary of ASCL, was one such leader welcoming the new PE, but said that there needed to be a reality check, as school timetables were already crammed with a multitude of expectations from the government in all sorts of areas, and it's a constant battle to find time for anything.
Barton followed up by saying that, quote, "There is a real need for a comprehensive curriculum review that slims down expectations and gives the right weighting to all of these competing demands."
I think this ties on really nicely with what you were saying, Carl, in terms of, you know, we've had this 57 million promise in order to keep school facilities open, providing this holistic education and an attempt to kind of put schooling, and it could be an idea to put schooling back at the heart of the community, with increased sports facilities, you know, and the money's for targeting girls, disadvantaged pupils and pupils with SEND, how can this money be used to encourage pupils with poor attendance back into school?
Absolutely, that's a really powerful point. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe the £57 million came off the back of the Lionesses' win last year, which I think is fantastic. I know the government gets a lot of stick, so, you know, you've got to give credit where credit's due. So it's fantastic because we all realise the power of sport. Going back to what you're saying, how can this be used to encourage the young people? There's many, many practical ways. One of the things, when I was a NEETS coordinator and I worked in alternative provision, so for those who are listening, I'm sure everybody's familiar, but just to make sure I cover everybody. Alternative provision, is for young people who cannot, for whatever reason, stay in mainstream schooling, whether it's down to their behaviour or their particular needs. And we always understood when we worked on alternative provision to educate to the child holistically. It's not just about the grades. We obviously wanted them to get some form of qualifications, but we wanted to engage them in a different way, which was not like school because of the trauma they've had around school. So if you imagine you have a young person who's been thrown out of two schools, they come into your space and they've been told that basically they're more or less being put in the bin. So they're going to be very hostile when they first come in. It's almost like, I can't be bothered or I can't deal with you because all the other teachers and institutions I've been in are going to treat me badly. So one of the things I had to do was design the schemes of work or oversee the schemes of work design. And I made sure we put things that touched on the different forms of intelligences. So there's a theory by a guy called Howard Gardner, and it's called multiple intelligence theory, which basically said that our idea of intelligence is based on a very narrow field, which is academic intelligence or analytical intelligence. So math, science, you know, reasoning. But there's different types of intelligence. So if you look at someone like Lionel Messi, if you gave him a geography GCSE paper, I don't know if he'll, what grade he'll get. He probably could get a great grade in it, but he might not. But does that mean he's not a genius at what he does? Howard Gardner would say that he's got kinesthetic intelligence, bodily kinesthetic intelligence, which is the ability to move his body in a way that helps him in his environment, which is football, or somebody like Tyson Fury. So it's very much, when we were doing it, it was very much like, okay, let's try and build out the curriculum and put as many things, what we call touchstones, as many different types of things in there so we can try and find that person's unique talent. So whether it was music, so we had a lot of, we got funding from the government, sorry, National Lottery for a music studio, film, art, that type of thing. And what we found was that these young people who were very disengaged in learning, once they found their thing, whether it was music, a lot of them were musicians or aspiring musicians, a lot of them wanted to do sports, a lot of them wanted to do things with their hands, plumbing, being an electrician. Their behaviour started to get better. They started to engage better as well because now they felt that the learning was geared towards them. Now, I understand with the constraints on our curriculum, we're not allowed, you know, because we have to teach to the national curriculum, we're not allowed to do that. But this is where I feel like this particular initiative can work because now we're saying, okay, you don't like school, you don't like, you know, your maths and English, you have to get that, but we've got this activity perhaps after school or during break where you can go and, you know, learn. So here's sports. So, you know, you can go and learn. You've got a football coach here, boxing coach here. But what I felt with a lot of these provisions, I used to call it the Trojan horse, is because we can't say all of these kids are going to be footballers or boxers or basketball players. But through sport, they can learn things like teamwork. They can learn things like cooperation, good sportsmanship. They can learn things like, I don't know, being a good team player, how to talk to people, so on and so forth. And I think that that is a great gateway to try and, especially if you're dealing with a lot of disadvantaged learners or learners who disengage with school, I think it's a great gateway to try and integrate them back into mainstream schooling. So I'm all for it.
Right. Well, Carl, we know that you're a busy man. And unfortunately, that's all the time we've got with you today. It's been really interesting to get to chat to you. I know we've both really enjoyed it and hopefully the audience has too. Have you got anything you'd like to say to them just before you go?
Yeah, you'll see me at the conference. So I'll be talking about this at SEND. So thank you for listening. Please go and check out the Action Hero Teacher if you get the chance. If you like what I was saying, I do lots of blogs and different stuff. So if you go to actionheroteacher.com, I am all there. If Instagram, TikTok, Action Hero Teacher, just look up Action Hero Teacher. You'll find me in some way, shape or form.
Well, we may not have our guests with us, we still have time for a bit more content to cover yet. And this one's a follow-up from a main story that we had from last month, and a look ahead to the future of assessment.
You may remember that last month we sat down with Evelyn Ford, the president of ASCL, to discuss the wave of NEU strikes that were taking place.
Well, there certainly have been some updates here. NEU strikes continued with 2 days this month, 15th and the 16th. What followed was a period of intensive talks between the government and the major education unions. This culminated in a government offer of £1,000 extra cash payment this year and a 4.3% pay rise for most staff next year. The NEU has called for its members to reject the offer, with their online poll closing on Sunday the 2nd of April. Speaking with the BBC, Kevin Courtney, the NEU's General Secretary, said that his union was unhappy with the offer and believed it was not fully funded in schools, and that means that the majority of schools would have to make their own cuts in order to find it. This certainly isn't the last we'll be hearing on this story, so stay with us for future updates.
Speaking of the future, let's talk about AI. It seems like you can't go a day without hearing ChatGPT somewhere nowadays. Even my dad wanted to talk to me about it the other day, and he is not technologically inclined, let me tell you. There's no doubt that AI is going to play an increasingly large role in our lives. I mean, I imagine it will take over running this podcast from us at some point. Given the technological and I guess social phenomenon that ChatGPT is at the moment, it's not surprising that discussions around it would creep its way into the education space at some point.
Talking at the ASCL Leaders Conference, Dr. Jo Saxton, Ofqual's chief regulator, said that she would want students to conduct coursework under exam conditions if she was a school leader, so that pupils would be unable to cheat using ChatGPT. Adding that, I wouldn't be asking for pieces of coursework or the essays that contribute to the grade to be done at home or in the school holidays. I'd be doing them in invigilated conditions in my centre.
It's important that we stress that while speaking, Dr. Saxton was simply sharing her thoughts, and this is not yet official policy or any kind of statutory requirement. However, it could be seen as a sign of things to come in the future. Now that we know that these AI programs are capable of writing complex answers, we may have unwittingly opened Pandora's box, and assessment will need to change accordingly.
Saxton also reiterated a story that we had previously covered in the podcast before, that in 2023, grades will be lower compared to the quality assured grades of the previous few years as they return to a pre-pandemic grading and standards.
Dr. Saxton stressed that, quote, "It doesn't mean something's gone wrong. It's part of our national move back towards pre-pandemic normality." Well, that's all the time we have for this month, but before we go, you know how this goes by now. Time to talk about the Schools and Academies show. Alex, take it away.
The Schools and Academies show is coming back to London on May the 17th at the XL Exhibition Centre. Our guests today, Sarah and Carl, will be both speaking there in the Centre Theatre.
And there'll be many other fantastic speakers there as well, including the multi-time Olympic gold medalist Sir Mo Farah. We'll be sitting down live for an interview with John Severs, talking all about his humble beginnings and the role of his school and teachers in his journey to the podium.
Registration is now open, and a link to sign up will be in the description. So make sure you secure your place at the show today, and we look forward to seeing you there.
Well, I guess that's all from us then. Until next month, it's goodbye from me.
And that's a goodbye from me. See you next month.
This episode was produced and edited by Alessandro Bilotta, Sam Powell, and Alex Wallace. So we've covered a lot today, and as a result, we don't have anything extra to throw in for you here. Instead, we'd like to use this time to say thank you to someone who's been a key player in the podcast, but that you don't ever really hear from. That person is Alessandro Bilotta.
Alessandro has been instrumental in the production of this podcast and the Schools and Academies show, and we wouldn't be here today without him.
This will be the last episode with Ali's involvement, because he's leaving GovNet to take on new challenges.
By the time this podcast goes out, Alessandro will have already left, but we hope you're listening. And we would just like to say a huge thank you, Ali, for your insight, your support, and your patience. And we wish you all the best in your new position.